Hello, hello. Welcome again to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, Elle Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobspodcast.com. We're on all the streaming platforms, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Android, and so much more. If you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms, we would love it if you could like, subscribe, and share. Tell your friends, spread the good word. We are all about talking to the movers and shakers and innovators in the music industry today from all aspects of the music business. We just want to find out, hey, how did they get their career job? How did they get to where they are today? What decisions did they make? How did they start out? What obstacles did they face, etc.? So we have a lot of great episodes out there already. Every episode you can find on the Music Jobs Podcast website, and also obviously go to the streaming platforms and subscribe and check out older episodes there. Last week we actually had the wonderful pleasure of interviewing Scott Hawksworth, who is the founder of audioskills.com. So this is a burgeoning online music community specifically for producers, musicians looking at mixing, mastering, and recording. So there's a ton of online courses, there's resources, there's tools. And Scott had such an interesting background because he had this music, early music love, and then decided, I need to be sensible, I need to get an MBA. And then once he had his MBA and was kind of out in the world, it was like, I really miss music, how do I do this? So he talks about making that decision of starting an online music business and how his MBA has really served him. So anyone who's starting out, maybe starting their own business, or a musician who wants to know how to have more of a business acumen in promoting their music, I think there's some really, really good stuff in this interview. So I hope you will go back and check it out. My next guest is Gigi Johnson. And I would say that she is a very great candidate for the most interesting woman in the world. She is currently the inaugural director of UCLA's Center for Music Innovation at the Herb Albert School of Music, and she holds a PhD in Educational Change and Media Studies, an MBA, and a USC film production degree. She also has her own company, the Marimel Institute. She's had 9 different careers. She is a very talented singer. She is a disruptor, she's an innovator, she's an entrepreneur, and certainly proof positive that a non-traditional, non-linear, unconventional, and diverse journey can really mean a successful career trajectory in music and beyond. So on that note, we're going to kick things off with a favorite track. This is actually one of Gigi's tracks. She and her friend Mike put out a kids folk album called Old MacDonald Had a Zoo, and this is a really lovely version of Clementine. Here it is.
Ruby lips above the water, blowing bubbles soft and fine. But alas, I was a swimmer, so I lost my Clementine. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling Clementine. Now I'm lost and gone forever, dreadful, sorry Clementine. How I missed her, how I missed her, how I missed my Clementine. And I kissed her little sister, I forgot my Clementine. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling Clementine.
Hey, Gigi, thank you so much for joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Hey, great. Glad to be here.
So why don't we start my favorite topic, childhood. Let's hear about the household that you grew up in. Tell us about what kind of music you first remember hearing, listening to, your parents were listening to, that kind of thing.
We were a radio household. And in fact, I was probably the big radio listener. My parents had a bunch of old LPs, and we had a piano in the house that I played. And my dad for years was attempting to play the accordion. But I'm a child of an architect and a technical writer, though my mom also did a bunch of creative work. So I was singing from, gosh, probably 6 years old on stuff. My aunt was a professional singer back eons ago out of Fresno, California, and sang on the radio way back in the 40s and somewhat thrashed her voice as a young person. So there's all this interesting mythology about music in my household, including that you shouldn't sing from a young age. So I was encouraged to do a lot of other creative stuff and did, you know, general choir and community stuff for a really long time and didn't really start to, and also played, gosh, piano, clarinet, violin, kind of the traditional growing up in a middle-class household with a couple of sort of writer and technical parents, the type of stuff you get nudged into. So for me, music wasn't what I thought I would be doing at all, but I was encouraged to do whatever I kind of wanted to do. So I was doing writing and I was doing acting and tinkering in science and math and not having any idea that I was any good at any of it, just enjoying it tremendously.
That is incredible. So you were actually playing all these different instruments?
Over the course of probably grades 2 through 8, I was picking up a different instrument every couple of years and playing piano, though, since I was about 12. And writing some dorky songs. I mean, I was just sort of, it was just part of my kind of fun community life stuff. The creative things I was doing actually in that era, I was designing costumes, which is interesting. Wow. I have two young adult daughters now, and one of them is a semi-professional costume designer on the side. So I find that that echo to be kind of fun. And I did a lot of costume design, and it sort of led into my sort of weird conglomeration of backgrounds, because I've always had the belief of doing everything and trying to figure out how to fit all my passions in.
Can you talk, I'm curious, looking back on this, can you talk a little bit, you know, people say sort of the left brain, right brain, and the whole like science and math versus, you know, music and arts. I'm wondering if you know, because you obviously have like such a wide range and such a wonderful, diverse sort of mashup of everything. Yeah. What do you think about that?
I didn't think I was good at math and science until a couple of things happened when I was in eighth grade. I thought I was a normal kid. Hmm. So I just thought this was all normal. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a community that was a lot of engineers. I grew up in the Bay Area near Sunnyvale. And then I moved in high school down to Orange County in California, where there's also a bunch of aeronautical engineers. So I grew up with a lot of tech people around me. So that seemed really normal, and not actually a lot of performers and creators. So that was more to me where I enjoyed hanging my hat and doing things. I thought I was kind of, I don't know, normal and average. In fact, my mom got mad when I was in middle school that I got the award for the most average girl. And it was supposed to be this math thing, talking about averages. So we all understood averages. So I was the average birthday. I was the average height. I was the average weight. And my mom went to the school to go complain that I should never be treated as if I was average and never be labeled as such. Aww. So that was kind of the household I grew up in. Mm-hmm. That it, you know, I was supposed to be doing everything and enjoying everything and doing what I wanted to do, but the concept that I was average, I happily didn't have in my, the message was in my life, but I still kind of thought I was kind of average and normal, and this was a normal way to grow up because I was in an engineering community, but doing art stuff as things that made me happy and having a lot of support for it. So I was doing anything from dance to whatever as parts of the community, and did normal growing up stuff like Girl Scouts, etc., but was in community choirs and was sort of normal average person.
Hmm.
So it was an interesting sort of, I guess, mixed message. Yeah. But it gave me the ability to do a lot of creative work. I was doing anything from like designing toys. I was
goodness.
I had a bunch of interesting, crazy stuff. I had art shows when I was really little. So I was doing a lot of stuff and thinking this was kind of normal.
I love it. That's phenomenal. And I have to give props to your mom for refusing to have you labeled as average, even though it was, you know, not meant as derogatory.
It was meant to be a learning experience.
Right, yeah, right? I love that. So with all of these things, how did you kind of decide, you know, for secondary or going on to college? Like, where was your head? Where were you thinking, you know, you wanted to go to college and study, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, wow. This actually takes us down the rabbit hole. So I started voice lessons in ninth grade, and I already in eighth grade, this feels very granular going down to being this young and talking about this stuff. I won almost all of the graduation awards at my middle school, which the teachers evidently didn't talk. So I won all the creative arts awards pretty much, and I won all the math and science awards, and I won a major English award.
Wow.
So other parents were really pissed at my parents. But I had no idea that I was doing well in stuff and that I had, as I tend to joke with young people I now work with, superpowers. So my mom said, well, you can be singing, which I had really wanted to do more, if you actually take voice lessons and get the mechanics down so you don't damage your voice at this age. So I spent a year in voice lessons really working on voice mechanics and walked into a 10th grade in one of the top spots in our high school choir and realized that I was a very happy mezzo-soprano after not singing that way for a long time, and spent a lot of time in drama and theater and doing all that stuff, and really thought that I wanted to do musical theater because that's what I had exposure to. One of my funny stories is Debbie Voigt, the very famous opera singer, was ahead of me in high school.
Oh, wow.
So having Debbie, a phenomenal world-class soprano who hadn't yet figured she was an opera singer, ahead of me in school made me think I was pretty average. So had a wonderful time, though, singing. So I thought I would sing as part of my life. I love to sing. I would totally just sing every day as all I do if that could be for me a full wonderful living. For me, at times it's been part of my living, but it's not been a full part of it. I was really good at math and science, and I was fascinated by how the brain works. Again, I'm very bimodal. So I wanted to go to college in biology to go into brain science and then do creative stuff on the side. I was designing costumes at the time. I was doing all this creative work. But the core message I was getting is that's a really great sidebar. It's a great thing to do on the side. So I applied for college. I got into all sorts of nerd places like MIT in biology. And I got into a lot of folks' places, but my parents were not very well off. So I got almost no scholarship money and was not able to pay for almost any place that accepted me other than USC, which gave me a full ride.
Nice.
So that made my decision. I came in as a biology major, but trying to figure out what I could do creatively. I spent a bit of time in biology and realized that wasn't what I wanted to do. That was heavy duty lab work, and it's not what I wanted to do with my life. And I had a wonderful experience taking an introduction to film course. So I got a postcard. I tend to joke now and tell stories to a lot of the young people I work with that it's the little tiny actions that make you turn left or right. And I got a postcard from the TA back when we had postcards for grades and it didn't come out via email or in an online tool set. And I got a postcard going, you should consider applying to USC Film School. And I thought, huh, I should try to apply to USC Film School. So I submit an application. And I included in it a bunch of the wild and crazy things I did. I'd written a Russian play. I had, which is, I was doing Russian studies. Again, I'm not very focused. And I had all these different creative works and the costumes I designed and all this stuff. And I turned that in as part of my application and a lot of the music work I'd been doing. And I got accepted. I'd never picked up a movie camera in my life.
Wow.
And so I thought they were kidding me. And so I was sick as a dog with the flu when I got the acceptance, and I walked into their offices and wanted to double check that this was real.
Aww.
So that started me in film school, and I brought all the crazy combination of technical abilities and creative abilities to the what was just in its early famous days in the 1980s of what now is the gigantic USC Cinematic Arts, that it had its reputation from a lot of the folks coming through in the 70s. And I was going to class with a lot of the really phenomenal creative filmmakers who've done so many great things in the 1980s. And I was this creative geek that was bringing it all together and working on documentary work about kids. So I was sort of bringing this interesting mix of things together and getting a fire hose of creativity and tech stuff all at the same time.
Wow. Now, were you still doing music? Like any, I don't know, bands or music?
Yeah, I was singing with various groups on campus. Mm-hmm. I sang... USC has something called Songfest. I sang in Songfest and helped run it in my senior year. I was doing a lot of singing, but not trying to figure out what it connected together with. Mm-hmm. And so music it tended to be the creative sidebar for a really long time in ways that I, as a lens to the world, and I was enjoying going to a lot of concerts and having a lot of friends who were musicians, but wasn't thinking it was something I could do.
So you imagine yourself as a filmmaker, a director, that type of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Especially doing social change documentaries. That was my headspace at the time, that I was enjoying fiction film, but I was really intrigued by nonfiction film and wanted to travel the world and look at issues that way. So that was sort of where my heart was in a lot of things, mm-hmm. Trying to figure out how I could go see the world with the work I was doing.
Oh, that's fantastic. So now you've graduated.
And couldn't get a job.
Yeah.
I actually, along with another small group of folks, got the top student Emmy for documentary production in the U.S.
That's great.
That year. And none of us could get work.
Wow.
This was in 84. And so I sent out 200 resumes, got 2 interviews, and ended up in advertising and was singing on the side. So I was singing at various groups. I was doing folk. I was doing jazz. I was not doing solo stuff. As I tend to joke about it now, it's kind of the beer money performance equivalent, mm-hmm. that we were getting food and beverage, but not getting much pay for doing stuff around LA. And I spent parts of my sidebar of whatever I was doing for my day job, doing music on the side this whole time. So I went through kind of an interesting saga of working in marketing jobs and being told I was too creative and disruptive, and almost lost my job a couple times for being non-traditional. Longer stories for that would take like a 5-hour podcast of the disruptive things that I didn't know I was doing my first few jobs. Worked for a crooked film company. That was really fascinating. Worked with Whitney Houston on the Diet Coke commercials.
Oh, wow. I think I remember those. Yeah.
I was there during the tapings of it, so that was interesting and weird and wild to be there and dealing with her people. Mm-hmm. And then I decided to go to business school and ended up singing and being in bands while I was in business school, but really learned that I had a real knack for entertainment finance, of all things. Hmm. So I spent 10 years as an entertainment banker with Security Pacific and then B of A, and then singing on the side, jazz, for almost that whole time.
You went out into the world, right? And then you basically, mm-hmm. Kind of got shit on because here you are.
I was a woman in 1984.
Yep.
Almost. And I actually ended up being one of the top graduates of USC the year I graduated. Mm-hmm. All of the top women who graduated at that time became somebody's assistant or secretary.
Wow.
And the guys almost all went to grad school, at least of the cohort I was with. Mm-hmm. So that was normal then.
Wow.
It really was normal.
Your decision to go to business school, was that a case? Like, I'm just curious, what was your mindset? Was your mindset kind of like, I'm not going to deal with this bullshit. I'm going to go and get another degree that's going to give me more of a leadership position? Or what were you kind of?
Oh, totally.
Okay.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I realized I was in the wrong door. I came in a really interesting door, mm-hmm. and I tried to break out of the stuff I was doing mostly on sort of marketing back end. I learned a gigantic amount that helped me later in a tremendous way. I learned how advertising and PR worked across the U.S. Mm-hmm. I understood the basic economics. I memorized, every single market in the U.S. I understood how TV and radio stations worked, which I'm not sure I would have gotten that much of an insight in it almost any other job, but I was never going to get out of there. Mm-hmm. And I had met some people that had gone to UCLA's business school program who were very non-traditional folks. And I've been a non-traditional person this whole pathway. Mm. So I was looking for some place I could thrive. And that was the message I got.
Got it. Okay.
And that era, and I've the story continues as I taught there for a decade, that it was a group of interesting, fascinating people who came from all sorts of walks of life. One of the guys I did a lot of stuff with was a professional drummer, came back to school, and then he ended up being the COO of a major film finance company. He was in one of the couple bands that we had going then, and I was in a competing band at the time as the lead vocalist. So we were kind of this interesting group of people that all ended up there in the 1980s who were very non-traditional MBAs, who were looking to bring in many ways creative skills, changing the world skills, all together. I know this is probably a very different story than a lot of creative arts folks, but I sort of walked in that, can I figure out how to bring business to wrap around the creative industry side? And it ended up being better than I thought as a fit for me, and a bit of a gigantic transformative experience. But a lot of it was my cohorts in crime, who are still some of my best friends in the world, that I met through walking in that doorway.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you had that sort of non-traditional mindset, that it wasn't sort of this like state of resignation and like, well, I guess I have to do this, but more of, you know what, I'm going to get this MBA under my belt and use it to continue to this on this non-traditional, non-conventional path with all these different creative, disruptive experiences.
Yep. Well, in many ways, it really also set my mindset that this is what education can be used for. And this is actually what I do now in teaching it, that education changes you. And you don't know that oftentimes when you pick a degree, that picking a school and the mindset and the people that it's with, it's not the high a check the box experience, that it transforms how you look at the world. And it very much transformed all sorts of ways that I looked at the world. I didn't know what I was good at half the time when I was in school. And sometimes when you're in an environment, you don't see necessarily your superpowers while you're in it. While I was in my MBA program, I had the ability to really burnish skills I already had that I didn't recognize. But a lot of it is the tool set I've been using to wrestle with things for the 30 years since. Gosh, time goes by really oddly. And so, again, film school taught me the ways to look at things a lot, and business school taught me the ways to take the sort of money and people sides apart to figure out how to do stuff differently.
Wow, I love that. Okay, so now you're going into entertainment finance. So where did that lead you?
That was 10 years of my life. I went and talked to all the media CFOs I could find in Los Angeles. And I asked them who their favorite banking company was that was the most creative and interesting. And they all said one of two companies, Security Pacific or B of A. So then I had them introduce me in. So by the time it was time to recruit, both companies were ready to hire me. It's a method I recommend highly to people. It's to not walk in the front door. So I walked in the side door, and I then worked on some of the top entertainment media, film, radio deals of a decade. I got to travel the world. I got to work on the News Corp almost bankruptcy in the early 90s. I was working with most of the major radio station groups, and I was traveling extensively, and I was becoming the mom of three kids. The combination of traveling extensively and being the mom of three kids was not a great fit. And so after about a decade, and I was doing a lot of creative work on this side. I was singing in a couple jazz bands and fitting that in as I could with my travel and life. I was happy and not happy. I was saving a hoard of money, which gave me a lot of the ability to be flexible. But I was not heading down the door I wanted to head. And that was also the next step for most folks like that, is to end up in the finance offices at a major media company. All very nice people, not what I wanted to do.
Got it. And that was 10 years.
10 years.
I can't even imagine what you've observed, and, you know, being in LA and the sort of ground zero for, you know, entertainment and music, and watching it evolve like from the 80s, right?
Well, and also New York. So I was out of New York for about 3 years.
Oh,
so I got a chance to travel the world. I was also doing a lot of work in Europe for these companies and with these companies. So I got to know, I was on the deal team working on Paramount trying to buy Warner when Time Warner came together.
Wow.
I was taking a lot of companies through bankruptcy. So I went through the downside for a lot of folks, mm-hmm. doing a bunch of film deals, early cellular phone.
Wow. Crap.
Early cellular phone. So financed a lot of the early cellular companies and did a lot of the early cellular deals. Worked with the Adelphia folks, the ones who did the perp walk and absconded with $1 billion out of company funds. Worked with them and... yeah, lots of great stories about
I can only imagine.
Fraud and inappropriate behavior.
Yeah.
it was a great education. I made a lot of other people money. I set aside money so I could do the creative work I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I was a square peg in a round hole for about a decade.
Yeah.
And so many of my clients really appreciated that. Many of my other clients didn't quite understand why this creative, overly energetic, exuberant person was their banker.
Yeah, I can totally see that. So what happened after a decade? Did you just hit a wall or?
5 reorgs and 2 mergers later, I knew it was time to leave.
Yeah.
We went through a merger. I was at B of A. We went through a merger with Nations Bank, and almost all my accounts were given to these 2 years out of business school, young men from Charlotte. It was obvious that I was in the wrong side of the political game. And I went to my mentors at UCLA and said, hey, do you know of anybody who needs my quirky, eclectic group of skills?
Hmm.
And one of them said, hey, you should come to UCLA. The other was said, hey, we're really reorganizing. It's not time to come to UCLA. So I paid attention to one of them and stepped in to run what was among the most difficult 3 years of my life. It's a wonderful program called the Applied Management Research Program now at UCLA, but working with about 80 companies across the world for major change. So some of those companies were entertainment technology companies, so I got a gigantic dip into entertainment technology that way, as well as working with the United Nations, working with Amazon, working with all sorts of companies, looking at major changes that they wanted to do in the future. So it was a great education. And it was also when I started doing more creative work at the same time. So I started Groundlings. I started doing other things to try to broaden myself out now that I wasn't traveling like a maniac around the world and trying to figure out how to put together this creative space. Considering this is supposed to be talking about my career in music, this all came together kind of sideways and backwards.
I think this is so fascinating and so necessary because I think what I'm discovering through this podcast and, you know, and there's no linear path. Like there's no,
yeah. No, absolutely.
You know, it's completely go to music school. Don't go to music school, you know, get an MBA. Don't get an MBA. Like it's all over the map. And that's what I love about it, that there's no clear straight line. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about how, because I love that you kept pursuing this creative outlet, you know, while you're doing all this work. And how did that help you? Like, how did that help your day job, quote unquote? How did that contribute to your overall like evolution?
It's interesting. I keep all my notes and projects. And so literally I have this gigantic stuffed dragon head I met that's sitting at the top of my desk. Having sort of artifacts and outlets and other things help keep me both sane and spurred on to do different things and meeting different types of people. I wanted to do more with a lot of it, but didn't have the faith that if I stepped fully into it, I'd be able to have a living.
Mm.
And having grown up in a relatively poor family, having the ability to make my own financial decisions was fairly important in my ability to have independence. I married a charming gentleman who I went to undergrad with before I started all this banking, et cetera. And he and I both, for our now 30 plus years together, have been kind of patching it together. But that's allowed me to have the flexibility to have a certain percentage of my time in life doing creative work.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been the primary breadwinner with 3 kids for most of the whole time. So it's been an attempt to keep both balanced and keep sane and happy and healthy.
Mm. So it really did contribute to sort of your overall mental health and being able to exercise that creative muscle. Yeah.
But it also helped me, yes, and it also, there goes the ground length, right. Yes, and that it also helped me bring different things to my day job. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the fact that I deeply understood radio and television from being in PR, but also understood the creative side of creating for film and TV was a dramatic benefit for my entertainment finance career. A dramatic differentiation, and allowed me to understand a lot of things and have dialogues with lots of people at companies and understand where they were coming from and what their needs were. So it really illuminated a lot. And then I was able to bring a lot of what I knew from marketing and finance and to work with friends who were artists and friends who were starting their own cable shows or at one point in time. Well, so all was good in the world, and I was able to do a lot of creative stuff, but it also kept me dissatisfied. So the fact that I was having this schism in my life where I was doing a lot of desk job, day job stuff,
right,
and then attempting to make myself happy with creative stuff, ended up kind of at one point in time walking to a wall. In 2005, I had been at the university for 6 years and was doing a lot of really phenomenal projects. By that point in time, I was running, I'd recreated the Entertainment and Media Management Institute there, which is now called MEMS, and had built it with whatever resources I could scrape out of the school and with some donors, but to a point where it wasn't moving forward fast enough. And I was wanting to do more creative work. So I ended up throwing my hands in the air and saying, I'm going to take a leave or cut my work down to just teaching and see what I can do out in the creative world. And spent then from 2005 to 2000, well, it depends on how you measure it, 2014, living a grab bag of all sorts of creative, musical, and other things that made me really happy, but starting in about 2008 made me less wealthy. It's a much longer story, but in 2004, I ended up blossoming out my singing with a guy named Mike Salas, and we were doing about 40 concerts a year,
but
finding a really great niche in kids' folk music. So we did a cable show and concerts and several albums, and was learning then in that early age of YouTube how to do web series. So we had three web series, was one of the first kids' shows on Google Video before that got folded into YouTube. So we had schools and fans using our content all over the world for teaching things in kindergarten and first grade. And it was this crazy time. Attempted to option, this has been documented in other places, but tried to option the Dragon Riders of Pern series to turn that into a movie, and got to then know a bunch of sci-fi people through the McCaffreys, and that opened it up a whole bunch of doors. Was a general manager of two video on demand channels when video on demand was new. So I got a chance to play at the edges of a lot of things and was able to really blow things out and play creatively at the edge of creativity and technology for quite a while. And all that was set up by all the things I had done before that.
And you were also right. I mean, that time period too was exactly the time when things were really starting to take off, right? And the sort of tech revolution, et cetera, and all these new platforms and all these new, you know, all that stuff was just starting to explode. So how cool is it that you were right there?
It was. It was cool because I also got to be bringing new, inexpensive, creative content to these platforms when that's what they really could afford and needed. And I was able to build relationships and bring the lens of understanding traditional media and knowing people on the finance side, knowing people on the marketing side. And so music was part of this, that I was doing a lot of things with music and things with YouTube. You know, now that seems really normal, but that was very early.
No, it was. Yeah, yeah.
And then also was still teaching. So I was still teaching at UCLA's business school, and I was teaching about digital disruption, so it was a phenomenal excuse to talk to all sorts of people and drag them into class. Mm-hmm. So many folks who've been my students have come up to me later in life, said, "Oh my gosh, you introduced us to Twitter when it was like 2 months old.
Right.
Oh my gosh, that you introduced us to Rio before he created Vivo, and we got to actually see that thing being born from our class." Mm-hmm. So that's been one of my real joys in life, is being able to take creative technologies and connect people who now are off doing all sorts of great creative things in the world, in music, in film, in TV, in games. And they walk through my doors as a student, and able to kind of introduce them to all the stuff that has come from my diverse, somewhat crazy background. Mm-hmm. And then they've come back and they've then taught new people about what's possible and how technology and creativity come together, both in the music industry, which is a lot of what I am doing now, but also in media broadly defined, and those people still are friends. So that's all very cool.
I love that. And I think that's amazing. And just the fact that you were there, you know, like I said, like front row.
Now that makes me feel old on some of that stuff. But yeah, I was there. And in some cases, sort of seeing the risks that people took to get things to happen.
Right.
And as my husband appreciates, also occasionally buying stock when something was just coming out. Mm-hmm. So, that's been beneficial as well.
That's really smart. So you were doing this incredible sort of sabbatical, but not really, but doing all these different. And where did you kind of end up in 2014?
While I was on this walkabout, that's how we tend to frame it.
I like
doing it. All sorts of projects. And I created a small company called Merrimel, which I still own, that mm-hmm. owns all the IP and all those projects. And I do recommend to anybody to create their own small company that they put all the things that they create into, instead of handing them off to whoever that they're working for. So I got a doctorate, in large part because I enjoyed teaching, but also at times felt like half a human being not having a doctorate in teaching at the college level. I went to another phenomenal, crazy educational experience, and that's a place called Fielding Graduate University. Mm-hmm. And Fielding is a doctorate for adults. They call it all sorts of other things, but people who are not 22 years old and looking to do kind of a small prescripted area of things, it's to go create a doctorate with the work you're doing in the world. Mm-hmm. So I did a doctorate, which again changed the way I think, in looking at organizational change and technology in education and the creative arts. And so did a lot of work with educational organizations, rethinking how they taught, and added a whole nother area of crazy to my life. But a lot of really great people, but also got a doctorate, which let me do a lot more stuff. So I ended up during that time also teaching at UCLA Business School, at UCLA Music School, in Abu Dhabi, in Spain. I've had the opportunity because of that to kind of up my game and be looking a lot at sort of next generation sort of thoughts of where things are going, and be much more of a sort of a futurist on creative technologies, sort of really hold that space. So in 2010, I started teaching an internet marketing and branding for musicians class for what was just becoming the UCLA Herb Alpert School of Music. Mm-hmm. It was not yet a full school. It was more like a virtual school of pieces that had been around for decades at the university. And I turned to the Dean of Arts and Architecture in 2013 and said, "You guys need something that's really looking at all these innovative changes in the music industry. There's such transformational changes happening. You should own this space." And they said, "Yeah, but we don't have anybody to do this." I said, "Well, let me help you find somebody. Let me help you put it together. This isn't going to be me. You need someone who really, really owns the space and knows it, and give them the reins to go really wrestle with this." So after about a year, we talked about where things were going. And in late 2014, I became that person and was running then the UCLA Center for Music Innovation, looking specifically at all these technological and social changes and how they were changing how we create and collaborate around music, and how it changes that both the marketplaces and even what music is. And it was such a perfect time to be stepping into that position. Mm-hmm. So I was winding down my singing, kind of sadly, kind of it came to a natural arcing time around that time to be wrapping up working with Mike, who's still doing all sorts of great stuff, and began to really explore more what was happening in terms of how all these technologies were changing how we work together, how we create music, what music is, and all of that stuff, and building courses and programs and projects at UCLA with all these wonderful 20-ish year olds who are wrestling with the same things and starting their careers. So I'm still kind of singing, though that's in a little bit of a back burner. I've been doing lots of other crazy stuff, online classes, both with partners, including The Economist, but also ones that I have and run with other programs. I've got two other side organizations I run, and have three adult kids now who have become, having this really flexible, crazy walkabout time that I did, allowed me to be with them when they were going through high school and college and be able to help them with their crazy creative projects. So it's been an interesting time.
To say the least, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm very lucky to have the role I have at UCLA now, where I get to work with all sorts of phenomenal people across the industry and a lot of great creatives, and work with other people's organizations to kind of ask a lot of these questions, and meanwhile trying to figure out where it grows to.
Yeah.
As this music is going through a massive transformation, I've had the privilege of being on the advisory board for South by Southwest Music and work with a lot of other organizations who are trying to figure some of this stuff out. I miss my singing. I am not singing as much as I used to. I sing with a couple of organizations now on kind of a private event basis, but I'm not out doing recordings or that many live concerts anymore. But I get a chance to work with phenomenal artists now, which is really great.
That's great. And, you know, it's just for now. That's the wonderful thing about the voice, right? It only gets richer. And this is something that, you know, you can go back to in maybe a year or, you know, whatever feels comfortable. So
I would say, though, for a lot of people now, a vocal career is something that is it's a tended market space, right? Mm-hmm. That it's figuring out who you're trying to be and having people actually be aware of your music. Mm-hmm. And that is often, that was my real challenge for a really long time, is do I let my traditional folks know that I have this music stuff going on?
Interesting.
And for many, many years, I kept my identities really separate.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of which year I stopped doing that, where maybe that's a little bit of a Facebook thing, that I let my identities merge there, mm-hmm. and then kind of figured out what's my combined kind of curated space. And I think that's for a lot of people who are hyphenates or multi-potentialites or however you're labeling people nowadays.
Yeah.
That how to be separate identities. Mm-hmm. And how to curate those is an interesting challenge. I have several friends who are professional musicians and have day jobs where they work so hard to keep those separate. Mm-hmm. One of them, I definitely won't name names because he's still living through the end of this part, but he figured that for his remote job, he only really needed to work about 4 hours a week, but he didn't want them to know that. So he didn't want anybody to know that he was performing. So he really shut down that part of it. So it wasn't obvious to his management team that he was spending all this time performing. So he tried to figure things creatively he could do that were not visible.
Mm-hmm.
So he ended up buying a boat and sailing and learning to fly, and now teaches flying. And now finally that job's ended, coming back into being a musician and being visible, because he didn't want his boss to know how much joy and energy he got out of performing.
Well, and I think, again, you know, as you've spoken to, I would think, and you can speak to this, but I would think that more and more having a creative on your staff, so to speak, is really beneficial, because of bringing that sort of unconventional, outside of the box thinking and mindset and new innovative ideas that they can bring to an organization or business.
and vice versa, having mm-hmm. folks who've got a little bit more of a technical brain set also on a creative team is really important. Mm-hmm. I've worked with some of the major studios in the same question about the how do you put teams together who are a combination of creatives and programmers and coders. You know, how do you think about that balance and the different work styles and the different lifestyles that come from bringing those people together? And yet it's crucial. Having diversity creatively and technologically on teams is really important.
Yeah.
And brings really different outcomes and different ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We just have a few more minutes. So of course I want to ask what, if you can sum this up, what do you see going forward in terms of music and technology and innovation? Like where are we headed? If you can give us sort of a little snapshot.
There is a flood of content being created, and there is power in knowing the data behind it.
Mm.
Companies and organizations, large and small, who can figure out where the super fan and the audience is and how to make that connection and not be beholden to a single platform or company for it, will have real power going forward. Small venues, small clubs, artists who don't quite get the data side are going to find that they get lost. People are making more and more decisions based on anything from playlists to what Alexa parrots back to them when they give them a single sentence request. So I'm in the middle of actually negotiating with a publisher a book deal on this question about where we're going with a lot of this. And it's very data driven. And that's a good thing, because now you can find the fans who really love what you're doing and nurture that relationship. Mm-hmm. But you can very readily not own that relationship if you are pledged into one platform that can then change its rules and owns the data and can screw you over. So I'm finding a lot of young artists and young managers are really learning how to own that question and are beginning to really thrive with this. And I think it's going to be a data have and have not stuff. And I do think also finding great people to work with that really complement your work as a whole different type of community is a whole growth area. I think streaming is going to readily double. I'm really bad at predictions. I'm either really right or really wrong. there's lots of things I've said and out in the world that have proved to be really wrong over time. But I do think that we're going to have almost no downloads by next year.
Mm-hmm.
We're dropping it at ready double digits year over year now. Mm-hmm. And the fact that music is now a flow of information about the listener, where they are, what they're doing, what their emotional state is a real powerful thing and a really scary thing in the fact that we readily could become digital sheep. And having artists and communities really understanding that is really important.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I was at someone's business the other day, and they had Spotify up on, you know, the TV, right? It was like streaming Spotify, and they were playing a playlist called "The Most Beautiful Songs in the World." And I was like, who decided that? Right? I was like, who decided that these are the most beautiful songs in the world? But obviously the playlist had like a million followers. And it was just really interesting. It's like what you're saying about that becoming sheep in a way. It's like, who are the playlist curators going to dictate, you know, our musical tastes, et cetera, et cetera?
And at the same time, though, there's umpteen playlists. So what makes a playlist sort of win in this environment? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, for Spotify, they're about 30% paid, 70% ad-based. Mm-hmm. And so that they're sharing data about what, if you listening to that playlist and then what you do next to advertisers.
Yep.
So that your behavior is now what's being sold.
Yep.
So just because something's got a million followers in the playlist doesn't mean people come back and listen to it.
Hmm.
Part of it, the backside of this is some amazing amounts of data that your average person doesn't see.
Right.
So looking under the hood for this to say, okay, you know, I'm on this gigantic playlist, but I'm number, 40 on it doesn't necessarily mean that life's going to happen. But at the same time, being on and off a playlist is a gigantic change in economic fate for the short time you may be on it.
Yep.
Or long time. And so the data side of that and getting people to come back and actually listen is a whole level of ongoing marketing. There's some great stuff on there also about the what happens to not current releases, and reminding people of the music they love is a big part of the business. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole thing about reminding people to return.
Yep.
So it's a really interesting time right now.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time and I'm absolutely thrilled. This has just been so fascinating and inspiring and eye-opening, and I love your story. And I'm wondering if you can just share with our listeners how they can keep tracking you. how do they follow you? How do they get in touch with you? All that good stuff.
So there's a podcast I run out of UCLA Center for Music Innovation. It's called Innovating Music, and it's on all the major podcast services. So it's mostly listened to on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Spotify. A few other places too, iHeartRadio, but it's on all the major services. So we're on average every other week interviewing people about these technology issues and sort of social and structural changes coming from music tech. So glad to talk with people about that. Glad to be followed. And also if you have suggestions for guests, glad for that. Otherwise, at the Herb Alpert School of Music at innovation.schoolofmusic.ucla.edu, we have a newsletter that goes out on that. On my normal stuff, gosh, I'm all over the place. GGJohnson.net is okay. Some of the work I'm doing. Maremel, Maremel.com is a small research firm that I own that does all sorts of crazy research into all sorts of creative projects and what's happening with the futures of music technology and careers. I speak all over the place, so I'm involved with South by Southwest, so feel free to ping me around that time. Twitter, I am GGJohnson. A lot. There's other Gigi Johnsons. Most of them are somewhat pissed that I grabbed all the names up front.
Hey, you were there. You were there when it first came out. So too bad.
I was there very early for all this stuff. Maremel also on Twitter, Maremel, and a few other Twitter handles. They all link to each other. And on Instagram, I'm Gigi Louisa, Louisa Johnson.
Okay.
I'm probably in about 10 other places too. Those are the ones that come
just
to
mind. Just Google.
Just Google me. I'm all over the place on Google.
Okay,
that Google
great.
Thing. Yeah.
Well, I'm excited for your book too, and I'm totally going to subscribe to your podcast. So I'm really thrilled.
Excellent. No, I really love the podcast. People walk up to me, as I assume they do to you, in strange places and just start talking about it. So that's been actually very exciting, having the ongoing personal relationship with people that comes out of conversations about the podcast.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you again so much, Gigi. This has been just such a fun ride.
Thank you very much. And glad for that you reached out and we had this conversation.
That was a wonderful interview. I'm so grateful to Gigi. And again, let me give you her information. You can find her at ggjohnson.net. So GIGIJOHNSON.net. She's on Twitter at Gigi Johnson. And her company is called the Maremel Institute. Her podcast is called Innovating Music. And one of the things we didn't get a chance to talk about, but one of the platforms that she's created as part of the Maremel Institute, it's called nextcareer.me. And there's two amazing platforms. One is Design Your Creative Career. The other is Expanding Your Career Journey. Again, at nextcareer, nextcareer.me. So two amazing tools that I urge you guys to check out. I think they're really, really helpful and will really, really answer a lot of questions that you may have about your own career journey or how you're starting out or if you're doing a career change or something like that. So again, just so many resources that Gigi has to offer. So definitely follow her, keep track of when her book is coming out, et cetera, et cetera. So we are now ending another amazing episode of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Again, just a reminder, I have a post on the Music Jobs podcast website about music internships for the fall. Again, I'm just, you know, on social media, and when I see a post for a fall internship, I've added it to this blog. So if you just go to the Music Jobs podcast.com website, click on podcast, then search in the search bar for interns or internship, you'll see this blog post. Again, it's just any sort of listings I've seen from New York to Miami to LA to Nashville, anything I've seen for fall internships, I've just posted the information there. So go on back and check it out. I am your host, L. Ariel. I have a website called lariel music.com. That's lariel music.com. So I hope that you will go and check out my music. I had an EP drop last month called Diatribe with an amazing producer called Sound Control, and that is available on Spotify, Apple Music, Tidal, and all that good stuff. So have a wonderful week. Stay cool if it is really warm where you are. And again, take good care. And we're going to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you dare give up.